Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. William E. Dodd spent 4 years in one of the all-time worst jobs, U.S. ambassador to Germany, a stint that began the same year that Hitler was appointed chancellor. But Dodd was not the usual ilk for such a post. He preferred a cup of warm milk before bed, dreaded having to deal with Hitler directly, and admitted being slightly anti-Semitic. And he loved to write about the job and his complaints about the job. Using Dodd's writings and those of his opinionated daughter Martha and others, best-selling author Eric Larson taps into the scene from inside Berlin with his best-selling narrative, History in the Garden of Beasts. Right now, Eric Larson is with us by telephone from Chicago to talk about the book. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Hey, great to be there. Thanks.
The book... Well, let's talk about the unlikely prospect, first of all, of making William Dodd ambassador to Germany. It was sort of a thread that was woven throughout the story. His credentials were little to nil. He was a history professor.
Yeah. He was about as unlikely a choice for ambassador as anybody could imagine. He was not only was he a history professor, he was really kind of a mild-mannered history professor at the University of Chicago. He was chairman of his department, but he had, zero diplomatic training and actually probably zero diplomatic inclination at that point. But one reason he got the job is because Roosevelt, who had been inaugurated in March, in 1933, Inauguration Day was in March, Roosevelt had offered the job to a lot of other people, and they all, maybe more wisely, had turned it down. So that was it.
He took it, though, against his better judgment?
Well, it is a kind of a perplexing thing. Dodd, at this point in his career, was pretty unhappy with academics. He wanted to work on his own book. It was a multi-volume series about the Old South called, appropriately enough, The Rise and Fall of the Old South. And, he did make some earlier contacts with people who were connected to the State Department with the idea of maybe getting like a really lame job somewhere, like maybe in The Hague or something, so that, a true sinecure so that he could actually work on his book. But here comes Roosevelt offering him what was arguably the toughest job in diplomacy, although, of course, we see it that way today because right. 2020 hindsight. But here he was offered this job and he took it. He took it, even though he desperately wanted to finish this book of his. But I think what was at play mostly there is the fact that Dodd needed recognition, and he felt that at his point in his life, he was in his 60s, that the true recognition of his accomplishments had eluded him, and maybe this was going to be the thing.
He was not a party boy, and that was sort of the image, or at least the modus operandi, of a lot of diplomats at that time. It was throwing parties.
Yeah, he was not a party boy at all. And he arrived in Berlin with what his peers in the State Department and in the diplomatic corps considered to be a, tremendous disadvantage, in that he was not a rich man. He was not independently wealthy. Most ambassadors in that period, they received a salary from the U.S. government, but it was nothing compared to what they spent on parties and so forth. It was really their job to arrange the diplomatic functions. These glittering dinners and so forth. So Dodd arrives in Berlin. He doesn't have that kind of money, and also he doesn't have that inclination. He once bragged, actually, that he could throw an entire party with a single bottle of gin. he was very unlikely on a lot of different levels as a choice.
He had an interesting outspoken streak, though. He pretty much kept his opinions to himself when he was around the Nazis and so forth, but every once in a while he sort of lashed out.
Yeah, well, but even I would say around the Nazis, as things progressed, he didn't exactly. I won't say he spoke out in an obvious manner, but true to his principles, he did not kowtow to the Nazis. He tried to do things kind of obliquely, like one terrific speech. Well, I say terrific. I mean, one very interesting speech that he gave on Columbus Day in his first year in Berlin was on its face. Kind of an interesting historical journey among past dictators and tyrants, going back to Rome. But really what his intent was to obliquely criticize the Hitler regime, which was a stunning thing, actually, at that time. And we would lose sight of that today, but it was a pretty shocking thing for an ambassador to do.
Just joining us, my guest is author Eric Larson. He's written In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin, among many others. If you have a question or comment for Eric Larson, we welcome it. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page or tweet me at Ann Fisher, WOSU. In Chapter 47, When Everything Changed, this is the title of that chapter, we learn about the purge of June of 1934. And in his diary a week later, he's kind of giving up hope, you write. He writes that, quote, "My task here is to work for peace and better relations." And it goes on from there. I was wondering, was that really what Roosevelt intended at the outset, peace and better relations, or was it to just hold them at bay?
Oh, boy, complicated. You know, Roosevelt's mandate to, or Dodd's mandate from Roosevelt, was to serve as a standing model of American liberal values. It wasn't necessarily to work for peace, to try to come up with a way of dealing with the Hitler regime. It was simply to be there and stand up for our values. Now, partly what was going on, and again, you know, we come at this with 2020 hindsight, but part of what was going on is that nobody really knew how to evaluate the Hitler regime in 1933-34. You know, did anybody see him as the future, the guy who would in the future attempt to rule the world and who would deport Jews to concentration camps? You know, in 1933-34, no, probably not. I mean, There was an inclination, a tendency to see Hitler as this kind of maverick, crazy politician who simply could not possibly last. There was an awful lot of public opinion and government opinion in the United States held that Hitler was just too crazy. He couldn't endure.
It's interesting, you know, when you ask, you know, when I asked my parents when I was younger, how could you not know? After reading this book, if they didn't know at the outset what the problem was and what was going to come, how in the world would people back in the United States have any idea? Even though the newspapers were much more critical of the regime, what people were hearing than what would come out of the diplomatic corps for a while.
That is true. The newspapers were very critical, but another countervailing phenomenon was at play as well. And I was really startled by this, again, because, you know, I arrived at my research with all the baggage the rest of us have. But one of the things I was really struck by is how people who went traveling to Nazi Germany came away with a very positive impression of the country. Partly that was deliberately engineered by the Nazis, but came away with a very positive view of the country that for them undermined the newspaper accounts. One case in particular, which I think is one of my favorite anecdotes in the book, is about this famous radio commentator, Hans V. Kaltenborn, who was traveling through Europe, went to Berlin, and in fact told, after traveling around Berlin and Germany, told Dodd's consul general, a fellow named George Messersmith. He told Messersmith that he didn't see what everybody was complaining about. He actually accused Messersmith of falsely reporting bad things to the State Department. He didn't see the violence. He didn't see the stormtroopers, you know, roughing people up. Until, and this is just such justice, you know, until his last day in Berlin, Kaltenborn's leaving his hotel with his wife and son. They're going to go shopping on one of the terrific shopping streets in Berlin. And a stormtrooper parade comes by, and one of the things you had to do was salute, you know, do the Nazi salute. And, of course, Kaltenborn and his family would not. They turned to look in a store window. Somebody, one of the stormtroopers from this parade, came out and bashed his son in the head and knocked him to the ground. And Kaltenborn was appalled, but suddenly he saw the light, you know, on the last day of his stay in Germany. So it was very easy to be seduced. It was very easy to be deluded is, I guess, the fundamental point.
I thought it was quite shocking toward the end of the book, too. There was a mother of one of the diplomats, the Pierpont's, somebody, and she was there during the purge in 1934, and she thought it was exciting.
She thought thought it was exciting. Not only that, she thought it was exciting, but the fact that this purge was underway did not deter her from setting off on a car tour with family members of Germany, as you know, some 700 fairly senior and not so senior members of the party and not members of the party were being executed by Hitler's men.
You know, the times were different, of course. And even as Dodd put it, I mentioned earlier, he was slightly anti-Semitic, is the way he put it. It seemed to make him less sensitive to what was happening to the Jews at the time. They were starting to disappear. They couldn't own businesses. The home he lived in, the mansion he lived in, was only available because of the repression of the Jews.
Yeah, that was an interesting element to me, was that Dodd, partly it's Dodd's own frugality again. I mean, he wanted a big old house that was cheap, you know. And so it was the perfect symbiotic relationship. The owner of a private Jewish bank, Alfred Panofsky, saw an opportunity to protect himself and his family by having the Dodd family occupy the first three floors of their four-story mansion in Berlin. So there was that. But you know, getting back to Dodd's anti-Semitism, I have to emphasize that Dodd embodied what I guess one would have to refer to as the ambient anti-Semitism of the age. Mm-hmm. You know, America, there was a lot of anti-Semitism in America and in the world. I mean, there's an early public opinion poll held that something like 30% of Americans believed Jews had too much power, and 20-some percent felt that Jews should be, you know, shipped out of the country back to where they came from. You know, it's that kind of thing. So Dodd embodied a kind of a low-grade version of that that was, oddly enough, tempered by a real sense of personal justice. So on the one hand, he did have this tendency toward again, forgive me for describing it this way, low-grade anti-Semitism. Personally, I'm very binary about it. You're anti-Semitic or you're not. But he had this low-grade anti-Semitism. But at the same time, he could recognize when injustices were being done and would try to stand up to defend Jews through that spectrum, through the idea that yes, he was slightly anti-Semitic, but on the other hand, he also had this great sense of justice towards all people and would not tolerate offenses against Jews.
My guest is Eric Larson. We're talking about his book, In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Coming up next hour, it's All Sides Weekend. This week's host, Classical 101 host Christopher Purdy, and it's Books and Reading. His guests are Cassie Rose of the WOSU Book Critic and Kevin Griffith, who's a poet and English professor at Capital University. That's coming up at 11 o'clock this morning. Mostly cloudy day today, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, mainly this afternoon, a high of 81. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a low of 70. Tomorrow, more showers and thunderstorms are likely and also a high of about 83 degrees.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra. The seventh season of Jazzoo kicks off Friday, July 13th with Rock and Roll Meets the Blues, featuring Jonathan Elliott at the Columbus Zoo. Gates at 6:30, showtime at 8. Tickets and details at jazzartsgroup.org.
Listen to 89.7 NPR News anytime by streaming on the web. Just visit WOSU.org and click Listen Now, the little button at the top of the page. That's WOSU.org.
Support for 89.7.
Welcome back to All Sides with Dan Fisher. My guest is Eric Larson. He's the author of In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Interesting subplot for me. The whole thing was this how the fact that his worst enemies for much of the story were his own colleagues in the State Department.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
They hated him.
Well, they did seem to hate him, actually, and part of it was because he was unfamiliar to them. He was not of their ilk. You know, he never went to Harvard. He was not independently wealthy. He didn't embody the same set of sort of patrician values that they did, and so they saw him as really kind of a rube, you know, kind of mm-hmm. a country bumpkin placed in this very very important job. You know, he's kind of like this thought occurred to me throughout the research. He's kind of like a version of Jed Clampett, you know, the old Beverly Hillbillies, you know, and that's kind of how they saw him, you know, just this guy who suddenly transported from his quiet history job in Chicago into the capital of the Third Reich, where the prevailing belief on the part of the old line diplomats was that you needed to really put on a good show for these people if you were going to get their respect, show of power of social power and glamour and so forth.
Well, and to a certain extent, that's true. I mean, it seemed like the Nazis didn't really take him very seriously. But at the end, you question whether or not he didn't have some impact.
Well, you know, the Nazis did not take him very, very seriously. I don't want to say they didn't take him very seriously. They wanted him to be something that he refused to be. They wanted him to be more the traditional kowtowing style of diplomat, for example. Hmm. And again, you know, we bring hindsight to this whole thing,
right.
and maybe this doesn't seem like such a big deal, but... in 1933-34, one of Dodd's, you know, he was a very principled man. One of the things that he decided early on was he was not going to participate in Hitler's annual September party rallies. You know, these gigantic rallies that we're all familiar with. You know, from photographs and from Leni Riefenstahl's film Triumph of the Will. He was not going to participate in those. He felt they were purely political events and they had nothing to do with diplomacy. And also, he found them simply offensive. Now, to the Nazis, this was a real affront, and that's hard for us to believe. It doesn't seem that big a deal, but for them, it was a very big deal, and it stuck in their craw for a long time. So that's how, if I had to give Dodd a letter grade, I would give him a B+. I think a lot of historians have just sort of passed him over because, you know, this one year period essentially that I write about is really just one way station on the way to the good stuff, you know, for historians, you know, World War II and so forth. But when you look at it really closely, I really think that Dodd did a pretty good job. I think he did better than anybody else could possibly have done in that position, precisely because he was this quiet man of deep principle. And, you know, he just stood fast. He did exactly what Roosevelt wanted him to do. Yeah, another way I look at it is when he was on his deathbed in New York at the end of his life, he was made fun of from afar by one of the official Nazi Party journals. And my feeling is if you earned the lifelong hate of the Nazi Party, you did something right.
Right. Any publicity is good publicity, sort of.
Yeah. Yes, right.
Anna Marie in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Anna Marie.
Thank you. I've just finished reading your book and found it amazing, well-researched, and a very, very major era of world history. And I thank you for giving us this portrait. I also read your earlier book, Is it Devil in the White City?
Yeah.
Yes.
So you're a beautiful writer, and I'm very grateful for your contribution. I'm German, and so it was a particular interest to me. And again, I thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Anna Marie.
You're most welcome.
Thank you.
You know, a lot of, I've seen this, you know, in your other books and in narrative histories, the scene setting that goes on, and I've always wondered how you decide. I mean, do you actually look up the weather reports from that day and know that it was nice out? Or
I do. In fact, for example, I found a there is a website that has the historical weather readings from Tempelhof Airport in Berlin dating back to, I think, like the 1920s. So I was able to actually get a pretty good sense of what the weather was in Berlin on any given day, which was terrific. You know, it's a terrific asset to be able to talk about weather. I personally, you know, we forget we don't forget, but, you know, on a daily basis, the weather to us, certainly to me, and I'm sure to you, you know, rain and everything else, and god awful snow and winter, but you know, weather is very, very important to us as in the course of our daily lives, and yet weather is so often, I think, left out of books, both fiction and nonfiction, and yet it's so important to how people lived, and it conjures so many impressions in our minds of days that we've lived through. So if you say that Berlin, in, you know, on a particular day in February of 1934, you know, is gusty and rainy, and the weather is just nearly freezing and stuff, it conjures a certain sense in your mind, which just adds to the layering that has to be done if you're going to try and give people a vivid sense of a time.
You know, a main character in the story to me is the Tiergarten area. In the end, it felt like a refuge, but also a victim. And it is what you're referring to in the Garden of Beasts. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, sure. And I'll tell you, kind of interesting how the title actually and how the structure of the book kind of evolved. When I went to Berlin to just kind of, you know, get the lay of the land, one of the things that I was really struck by, and this is why it is so important to always go to the scene of the crime, if you will, and just kind of get a sense of it, even though in the case of Berlin, you know, that a lot of stuff was obliterated by the Russians, you know, in 1945 during the assault on Berlin. But one of the things that really occurred to me as I was walking around was how everything that you know is now going on in the book was centered around the eastern quarter of the Tiergarten, which is this terrific central park in Berlin. There still is a Tiergarten in Berlin, but it is, of course, it's 100% different than it was in 1945. It was absolutely leveled back then. I mean, I'm not kidding when I say leveled. But one of the things that struck me is that everything was walking distance from everything else. From the Dodds house to Gestapo headquarters was a relatively brief walk. From his house to Hitler's chancery was a brief walk. To the Reichstag across the park, a brief walk. So everything was centered around the park. And here was the park, though, that was also used as this place. It was one of the few places, maybe the only place in Berlin, where you could take a stroll and be really confident that you were not under some kind of audio or even visual surveillance. It was the place where diplomats met. Dodd routinely arranged to meet with other diplomats, his counterpart in Britain, for example, from Britain, in the Tiergarten, because they could take a nice quiet walk and converse in a relaxed way without worrying about microphones. So all that together really made me think, yeah, the Tiergarten really was kind of, thank you for pointing that out, really was kind of a character. And also when you go to the literal translation, you know, Garden of Beasts or Park of the Beasts, I kind of liked it. It seemed to encapsulate the whole thing.
I liked it.
No, good.
Chuck in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Thank you. I'm a little amazed at why President Roosevelt didn't see more coming, or did he see more coming? Why did he send this particular man? It seems like he would have had to send somebody with much more diplomatic capability than this man, because Europe was about to explode.
Well, you know, let's remember, let's go back to 1933, 34, and you say, you know, Europe was about to explode. But, you know, nobody really understood that in clear detail in 1933, 34. What they did understand is that Germany had kind of exploded, or maybe imploded, and that this crazy bunch was in power. The Nazi Party was transforming this nation. But I don't think anybody possibly would have foreseen what was going to come down the road in just a matter of, you know, four, five, six years. Because, again, it comes back to the sense that Hitler was was this completely anomalous character. How could he possibly endure as the leader of a modern European country? So, in some ways, Dodd made a lot of sense. He was kind of a moral. He's kind of like planting the American flag in the center of this cauldron of rising Nazi power, just to say, hey, you know, we're the adults here, and you know, we're watching, and you know, we're going to see what happens. But let's also not forget that Roosevelt did try to have place much more seasoned diplomats in the position, and none wanted the job.
Thanks, Chuck. Well,
for obvious reasons.
Wasn't it the fallout of the Treaty of Versailles that they were just taking everything from Germany? Wasn't this one of the reasons, the answer was Hitler? Because the Treaty of Versailles, they just came in and took everything from Germany.
Yeah. You know, let me address that by saying what Dodd believed. Dodd personally believed very strongly that the Treaty of Versailles was a mistake, and that that it did contribute a lot, really was what caused or allowed Hitler to come into power. You know, Dodd was not by any means excusing the Nazis, but he was looking at the regime with a little bit more sympathy than maybe any of us would today because of the strictures imposed on Germany by the Treaty of Versailles. So, yes, that's quite right. Now, you know, to the extent that I think a lot of historians would tend to agree that the Treaty of Versailles did lay the groundwork or if you will, plow the field for the Third Reich, but you know, again, that's something that somebody else could talk about more expertly than I.
Thank you, Chuck, for the calls. If you'd like to give a call and talk to my guest Eric Larson, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Eric is the author of In the Garden of Beasts: Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. You focus on a year, but he lasted 4 years, right?
Dodd?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was surprised he lasted 4 years.
What? That's interesting that you said. I think actually, well,
maybe
I guess,
it's. I'm sure it's 2020 hindsight.
Yeah, well, it is 2020 hindsight, but you know, I think that my feeling is that. Well, yeah, I'm getting into personal opinion here. I mean, I would have liked to see Dodd stick around a lot longer because the Nazis were really ticked off at him, you know.
Uh-huh.
And again, I think that's a good thing. But yeah, he lasted 4 years. The first year was I focused the book on the first year, which was essentially from the July 33 through July of 34, because that also pretty much tracked that very very much crucible like year for Hitler. I mean, from a writer's perspective, it was a wonderful confluence of time. I mean, the whole narrative structure of the book is based on things that happened in that first year, both in the Hitler regime and for the Dodds in Berlin, and it embodied really a classic narrative arc, you know, building towards this really gory climax during the Night of the Long Knives. It was like heaven sent from my perspective. Of course, the people living at the time might disagree, but.
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, speaking of heaven sent, what about his daughter, Martha? Divorced, 24 years old, and wrote in a journal regularly and thought of herself as a writer and ended up being an author, and she was prolific and detailed.
Yeah. She was a terrific character to come across because, and she was really what made me decide that the Dodds would be my. Yeah, I started out with the idea that wouldn't it be interesting to try to take a look at this early period of Hitler's regime through the ideas of characters living there, real people living there at the time, with an idea to try to get a sense of what it would have been like to have been there without knowing what we all know today, without knowing the ending. So I set out very deliberately trying to find characters, and I first stumbled across Ambassador Dodd's diary, which I found interesting, but that wasn't enough right there. But it's when at some point later that I again stumbled across his daughter's memoir, that was when I realized that these two characters were really going to be my characters, because they both brought to Berlin a certain certain kind of naivete. Martha, I was startled to find, you know, as soon as she gets to Berlin, she falls in love with the whole Nazi thing. She refers to it as the Nazi Revolution. She is caught up in the enthusiasm of the young men, and I mean, she just fell for the whole thing. That stunned me. I mean, I had never known that you know, the daughter of America's first ambassador to Nazi Germany had fallen for the whole thing. I thought that was amazing. And then the more I read about her and this affair she had with the first chief of the Gestapo, that alone was startling. But what was also startling to me was I hadn't known that there was a first chief of the Gestapo, Rudolf Diels. I'd assumed the bad guys, Himmler and Heydrich, were in power from the start.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I learned that Rudolf Diels, who in many ways is my, I don't want to say favorite character because that connotes something else, but maybe the most compelling to me. I mean, here's the first chief of the Gestapo sleeping with the American ambassador's daughter, but he was also widely respected by the diplomatic corps as a man of considerable moral integrity. He was the man you went to if you wanted to extricate your foreign nationals from a jail or, you know, one of the new camps like Dachau. And he was considered a good guy, you know? How strange is that? So there were all these little revelations, and that's what made me decide these were going to be my two characters.
She was divorced. Well,
trying to get divorced,
that's right, at 24 years old. Lovely by, you know, although Hitler didn't think much of her looks. But.
Hitler didn't think so much of her. But you know, let's quote, well, I don't want to get down to the level of looks, but I've had readers point out to me, say, well, she wasn't that good looking, you know? But that's not the point about Martha. The point about Martha was she was good looking in her way. But beyond that, she was one of these people we have all known in our lives who, you know, whatever the level of sheer physical beauty, they had something, that they had this thing that inflamed the passions of others, and she had it in spades. And so.
Charisma.
Charisma, yeah, for lack of a more precise definition, but yeah, charisma.
Now,
Sexual charisma.
Right. The Nazis, although she fancied herself very much an intellectual.
I think the thing about Martha that made her kind of, in my view, kind of a tragic character is that she always wanted to be something greater than she really was capable of being.
She worked at it. The Nazis didn't really take her very seriously. The Soviets, on the other hand, wanted to make her an agent and worked through another of her lovers, the most serious among them, I guess. But it's unclear at the end whether he was wooing her for anything but as a recruiter.
Yeah, you're talking about Boris.
Boris
Vinogradov.
Right.
I loved him as a character, too. My take is that he did love her initially. But I think he was very honest with Martha when early on he tells her that his first love is his country, is communism. And he was not kidding. You know, I think he was one of those ardent political souls who were so common in that period who, yes, he loved Martha, but when he was approached and told that there was a greater mission that he would have to perform with regard to Martha, I think he went for it. But I think he also, you know, relationships, you know, wax and wane, and I think their relationship, as time passed, did wane, and the espionage part of the relationship took over.
My guest is Eric Larson, author of In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
At the top of the hour at 11 o'clock, it's All Sides Weekend with your host, Chris Purdy, and it'll be books and reading this weekend. His guests are Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic and poet and English professor at Capital University, Kevin Griffith. That's coming up at 11 o'clock this morning here at 89.7. In the weather, we'll have mostly cloudy and a chance of showers and thunderstorms today, a high of 81. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers again and a low of 70. By Saturday, showers and thunderstorms, mainly after 1 p.m., very specific, and a high tomorrow of 83 degrees.
Hey, did you hear Car Talk last week?
The woman who got turned off when she saw my car in the driveway. I didn't get to square one.
Well, how many miles are on you, Glenn?
If
Brad Pitt were driving the CRX, I don't think he'd have any problems.
Now you're hurting me.
Join us for more keen yet sensitive analysis this week on Car Talk.
Starts at noon on Saturday right here at 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from OSU's John Glenn School of Public Affairs, offering continuing education and graduate degree programs designed for the working professional. More information at glenn.osu.edu.
Subscribe to WOSU's e-newsletters and find out what's going on. Visit wosu.org/email for more info.
Hey, did you hear...
My guest is Eric Larson. He's the author of In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. If you have a question or comment for Eric Larson, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. A lot of interesting nuggets in the book about the Nazis, and one was, I think this was from Dodd's diary, he wrote about how they treat their farm animals, their horses, their dogs, better than each other.
Right.
He called it horse happiness.
Yes, it's one thing. First, a little back note. Dodd was really, he loved this farm that he owned in Virginia, in Round Hill, Virginia, which now unfortunately is a golf course. But he loved this farm, and he loved his animals, his horses, and so forth. So he had an appreciation for wildlife and so forth. And one of the things that he noticed in Berlin, on his frequent walks, he walked everywhere, which again cuts back to the importance of noting that everything was walking distance. But he loved walking through the Tiergarten, and in the Tiergarten, everything just seemed so civil and normal, with people with their matrons, with their dogs, and people would be riding horseback routinely through the parks, and they took such great care of these animals. At least that's what Dodd perceived, and he was really struck by the irony that this people could be so respectful of their animals and yet treat Jews and political opponents of the regime and so forth with such cruelty and violence. It really struck him as a very strange irony.
You've written several books with subjects that include murders, serial killers, deadly storms, and this one, of course, the most terrible of subjects, Hitler and the Nazis. What draws you to them? Is it that darkness, or is there something, is it a constellation of things?
Oh, it is so many things. The idea process for me is so contorted and complex and fraught with dumb luck that it's impossible to say that I'm drawn to anything. I'm drawn to whatever is the best possible story that presents itself at a given time. It just so happens, though, that dark things are often the most compelling when you look at them. I would argue, though, that Devil in the White City, for example, yes, it's got a thread involving serial murder, but it's also really about the very transcendent act of civic goodwill that resulted in the World's Fair of 1893. So it's kind of a dark and light story. But yeah, I guess it's fair to say that when ideas present themselves, if all things being equal, I will choose the darker, just because it's more dark. It's scarier.
The film rights of this book have been optioned as a potential starring vehicle for Tom Hanks, and I was thinking William Macy. What about you?
William Macy, you mean for Dodd?
Yeah.
Boy, that's interesting. I think I prefer Tom Hanks.
Okay.
I prefer Tom Hanks. But William Macy, I've never been that big a fan of William Macy.
Oh, okay. Well, see, there you go.
Yeah. So.
So, but what do you think about when they start casting the characters? Do you have any ideas?
You mean for Martha?
Yeah.
Or for Dodd? Well, Dodd, Hanks wants to play Dodd.
Right. So Hank, that's a done deal. Yeah. If he wants it,
yeah.
He gets it.
So what about Martha? Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, the first person who immediately leapt into my mind was Scarlett Johansson.
Oh.
That's what just popped into my head. However, I think I happen to know that there is somebody else contemplated, but I'm not at liberty to talk about that.
Okay. We have an email from Randy. Asks, do you think that his daughter helped him more in his role or hurt him?
Oh, you know, I actually don't think his daughter really had much impact on him or what he did per se. She may actually have provided some sub rosa streams of intelligence to him, you know, through her contacts with Rudolph Diels and so forth. But I think if she hurt him, it was only because of the fact that the guys back in the State Department who hated him were looking for any and all things that would add to the dossier of badness about Dodd so that they could get him out of the office. On balance, I still have to say I don't think she really caused him that much harm.
An email from Pat asks, did you come across Charles Lindbergh in Germany while researching this book?
Did I come across him? Yes. But, you know, only he really came into the picture much later in the process. And Lindbergh, boy, there is a complicated character with regard to the Nazis. But I'm really not expert enough to talk about it.
David in Delaware, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, David.
Hi, Mr. Larson. I just want to congratulate you on your last book. I found it fascinating history, the way you kind of layered the different themes and whatnot. And I'm excited about reading your new one. I'm going to go out and get it today. So
all right,
thanks.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
614-292-8513 is the number to call if you'd like to speak to my guest, Eric Larson. We're talking about the book In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. Going back a little bit to our conversation earlier about the Americans being beaten in the streets for not raising their hands for the Heil Hitler and right. That sort of thing. How could that happen and things not get out about Nazi Germany? And that was early. That was in the first year.
Yeah, that was quite early. Yeah, and, you know, that first of all, that was one of the elements of the story that to me was also surprising. You know, I of course, you know, I knew about the violence against Jews, but you know, like a lot of people, I think my knowledge of that element. People tend to, and I think I was guilty of this as well before I got into this book, people tend to look at the whole period, 1933 through 1945, as essentially one homogeneous period of horror and war. Like, that's World War II right there, right? But when you get into, you know, the finer viewpoint of 1933-1934, in fact, at that point, violence against Jews had fallen off drastically in Berlin. But what had begun happening, and I had never known about any of these attacks, was that probably essentially seemed to work out that probably about once a month an American would run afoul of this whole Hitler salute thing. It would be roughed up and at times really rather severely roughed up. And which, of course, sent the embassy into investigative mode and protest mode and so forth. But these assaults, typically when somebody failed to raise the hand when a stormtrooper parade came by, were really really startling to me. Were reported by the U.S. press. But they didn't seem to make any kind of deep resonating impact on overall American public opinion about Germany. You know, one other thing to point out is that one background force that was very much at play in the United States and actually throughout the world, those who had participated in World War I, was that there still was this miasma of grief and sorrow lingering after the close of World War I. Nobody wanted another war. I mean, it's hard for us to perceive that today. We talk about appeasement, and frankly, we talk about appeasement rather blithely. But when you go back into that period and you look at the world through the eyes of Americans, and especially through the eyes of the British populace, the last thing anybody ever wanted was war. And so you had that real powerful force back there as well.
So they would avert their eyes.
Well, it's not so much a question of avert your eyes, but you know, you didn't want to get all upset about everything. You know what I mean? You kind of had to pick your fights, and maybe an American getting roughed up wasn't the thing. For example, there would be people who would try to rationalize what the Nazis did to these Americans by saying that, look, the Americans are in a foreign country and they should follow the customs of that country, and they failed to do so. So they deserved it. You know, it's that kind of thing.
Rick in Cincinnati, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Rick.
Hi, thanks for having me on. Mr. Larson, I'm about 160 pages into this book. Fascinating. A little dense. I'm having a struggle with it here and there, but a little dense. I also read the White City, Devil in the White City, and same thing. Enjoying it, though. It's a challenge, so I appreciate that. My question is, are there any evidence of the other members of the diplomatic corps as allies? How were the British reacting to these riots in the beatings in the streets, or how are the Spanish embassy? How was that reaction happening? I know Spain was about to get a bunch of help from Germany, so they were probably pretty quiet.
Right. Well, let me talk about the British, because Dodd had a lot of contact with the British ambassador, Sir Eric Phipps, who was a marvelous character. His diary, if you can find it, it's available. It's in hardcover. I think I got mine through abebooks.com. But he was just this tremendously articulate and wry fellow who had absolutely no illusions about the Third Reich. He and Dodd were actually quite good friends and shared a lot of the same views of things. But the story back in Britain was very complicated. There were an awful lot of people who were very critical of the Nazi regime, but there were an awful lot who were very sympathetic to the Nazi regime. In fact, the London Times, there was one of the correspondents in Berlin, and there was a very talented pool of correspondents in Berlin in this early period. One of them worked for the London Times, and he would file these very critical pieces about the Hitler regime, only to have them severely edited and their tone utterly changed for publication in the London Times, so that they came out much more favorable, if not outright favorably, with regard to the Hitler regime. So it was a very, very complex picture.
Thanks, Rick.
Hello?
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, thanks.
Take care. What about the media in general, the U.S. media, not just reporting the beatings of the Americans and that sort of thing, but in general reporting the politics of what was happening? For instance, after the Purge, how was it reported? Was it covered?
Yeah, the Purge was actually pretty well covered by the correspondents who were I hate to use this term, but who were on the ground in Berlin, like Sigrid Schultz in particular. She was one of my favorite characters in the book, a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. But there too, there were questions of the underlying ideology of various newspapers. For example, her newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, was adamantly isolationist. Did not want America to get involved in anything abroad. And here's Sigrid Schultz, who is almost on a daily basis filing stories about beatings and bizarre political machinations and, you know, secret arming and so forth. And you know, much of her work did make it into the paper, but she was under a lot of pressure to not report on, you know, the rotten things about the Reich.
At the very end of the book, the very, 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 very end of the book, you have a quote from the author Christopher Isherwood, and the underneath it says, "Down there on a visit." Is that from a book that he wrote or from a memoir?
Yeah. Well, first of all, that quote, I have a feeling a lot of readers missed it, but I stuck it there very, 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 very end of the book, after the index, as kind of a treat to my diehard readers, which I guess includes you.
Well, so, I like to look at indexes as a weird thing.
Okay. So this quote comes from a book of his, down there on a visit, and it is a quote that has to do with when he returned. He had lived in Berlin in the early years of the Hitler reign, then left wisely. And then he came back after the Russian assault in 1945, when the rubble and the devastation was still very, very fresh. And he found himself walking through the area of the Tiergarten. In fact, one of the things he talks about in that quote is the very train station that Dodd and his daughter and family arrived, where they arrived after taking the train from the port where their ship docked. And it's a very, very melancholy kind of an observation. But the thing that is really central to it is when he says, you know, what he was really struck by is this could happen to any city at any time, and nobody should be fooled. And that, to me, it's not why I set out to do the book, but at the end of the book, that really seemed to encapsulate what the book is about.
Because you realize if it could happen, I mean, the way it unfolded, you get it more when you look at it from the perspective of the ambassador's family, and that it happened right under their nose.
Yeah, it happened. And not only that, it happened so quickly. Mm-hmm. You know, a very liberal Weimar culture was transformed essentially in the space of a year into this tyrannical, oppressive realm. And wow, how does something like that happen so fast?
Did this book lead to the next book, or how does that work?
What do you mean? You mean
did it inspire you in another direction in and of itself, or are you completely...
In the Garden of Beasts,
yeah.
You know, I have a number of ideas that I would really like to pursue involving the Third Reich, but I make it a point not to. I don't want to get caught in a shtick, if you will. I don't want to be typecast. So, my next book is going to be completely different.
Well, thanks for joining us today to talk about this one, Eric Larson.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Appreciate it. Eric Larson, author of In the Garden of Beasts, Love, Terror, and an American Family in Hitler's Berlin. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.